Good evening, listeners. It's September 16th, and you're tuned into 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is currently just after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday, that can mean only one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Lillian Paget-Cobb.
And I'm Kristen Finch. At Oregon State University, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you are a graduate student at OSU, or you're just interested in learning more about all research and activities at Oregon State University and the awesome things that graduate students do, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all of our upcoming guests, links to our Twitter and Facebook pages, and how to sign up for the show.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. Tonight, we are joined by Liz Jonk from the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies program in the College of Liberal Arts. Hey, Liz, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So your research falls within the field of MAD studies. And can you tell us more about what that encompasses and what it is that you do?
Sure. So first of all, I think I should clarify that by MAD, I don't mean angry, or at least I don't just mean angry. By MAD, I mean crazy, insane, unwell, disturbed, psychotic, manic depressive, bipolar, borderline, mentally disabled, ADHD, autism, spectrum disorder, and a host of other things that people position themselves as or identify with. And MAD studies is a field of studies that interrogates concepts of normalcy, especially around the mind, or I like to say the body-mind. After many disability and MAD studies scholars, they refer to the body-mind as like a whole entity. You can't separate the mind from the body. And MAD studies in particular thinks about, critiques concepts of wellness and sanity and logic or reason. And I would add to that that many MAD people sort of consider MAD studies the academic arm of the MAD Pride movement, which is a movement that organizes MAD people of all kinds against things like forced psychiatric incarceration or institutionalization, forced medication, and the general stigma around being MAD or being pathologized as such.
Okay. So one thing I'm curious about is, your research, you're looking at a specific focus within MAD studies, more of the historical, placing MAD studies within a specific context.
Yeah, so I definitely would not refer to myself as a historian. I just want to clarify that in case the history kids are getting nervous already. But I think it's fair to say that I do look at the stories of MAD people across space-time. So primarily, and I should position myself here, I am a white Euro-settler, genderqueer MAD person. I'm a grad student. That comes with some kind of economic entitlement, so to speak. So positioning myself within that space-time, I'm mostly looking at scholars and artists and activists who are working on this continent. And the ones I'm most interested in are those who are disrupting narratives that tend to think of madness and psychology and psychiatry, or what I say is the psi sciences after MAD study scholars, they're disrupting these narratives that imagine those things to be coming out of primarily Eurocentric and Amerocentric imagination. So like, what does the white settler Western mind imagine wellness to be, imagine madness to be? How is it treated across time? And so I'll just name drop Michel Foucault here because he's really famous for his analysis of, like, a historical analysis of madness. And really just challenging scholars like Foucault who yes, while they have done some really important methodological work, they were looking at an extremely limited populace and then trying to generalize that to everyone across genders, across disabilities, across nationalities and sexualities and so forth.
Okay.
So would you say that that kind of historical tradition of kind of that Foucault kind of set up is really ignoring or trying to put folks into groups, but ignoring many other identities that that are now becoming more known or more discussed in academia?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's the tendency of Western academia to ignore or even pretend that whole groups of people don't exist. So it's both an intentional and unintentional marginalization of those people. And the scholars that particularly draw my attention often are coming out of those multiply marginalized positions and pushing back against these taken for granted narratives. I think an example of this is, like, you know, when we see medications for antidepressants advertised on TV, it's often like a middle-aged, apparently cis heterosexual white woman in the commercial who's looking really glum and apparently can't play with her kids or make them sandwiches for lunch or what have you. And so that's, I think that's one example of how proliferate certain stereotypes are about madnesses and disabilities that attach them to identities that are more readily accepted and studied, for one thing, by the psi sciences and just within the mainstream and sane stream in general. And so the scholars that I'm talking about, I'll name drop Gloria Anzaldúa because I'm like a Gloria Anzaldúa fan kid. Mm-hmm. And she's really disrupting what it means to, like, talk about whiteness, for one thing, coming from a mixed race and border crossing identity. She often positions herself as having a liminal or almost ambiguous identity in terms of race and nationality and language and so forth. And those kinds of scholars get us to reorient the, I guess, so-called history or even the so-called origin stories of the psi sciences and madness. Like, where does madness come from? Supposedly psychology has some answers for that, but the stories that Anzaldúa is talking about are much older than the Western conception of the psi sciences, if that makes sense.
So there's this history that extends beyond really the what's been explored by the status quo academic establishment. So for Gloria Anzaldúa, you were talking about her story that, or I guess her perspective extends back much further.
Yeah, so she's considered like a preeminent Chicana feminist, but she is also working from indigenous epistemologies and cosmologies that... I don't want to say they refute the existence of madness per se, but they definitely position it as something completely other than the sort of disturbance or even in some cases abomination that the psi sciences imagine madness and mental illness and so forth to be. Like, the mentally ill or crazy person is defective and in need of cure within a medical model that the psi sciences promote. But in many indigenous traditions, not just the one that Anzaldúa was working from, that's very much not the case. Not to, like, mystify crazy people per se, but I just think it gets us to sort of blow those models wide open and think of the body mind as something completely different than the one that often has these, like, overlapping categorical stereotypes put on them. And again, that, like, totally erases whole body minds of people of color, of queer people. Yeah.
So this, what you mentioned about going back to the stereotypical antidepressant commercial, in a sense, where there's an idea of the model of what a depressed person might look like. And when we spoke for leading up to this interview, you had mentioned that there are these shifting ideas of what constitutes illness or wellness through time, depending upon sort of the social and cultural climate.
And on that point, maybe depending on who is in power, I think, Lily, you're trying to get to is...
Yeah, definitely.
Who is making the diagnosis and what is... Right. How is that serving them? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, overwhelmingly, until super recently, in at least on these stolen lands, and we can also talk about what I mean by stolen lands, definitely... you know, cis masculine white settlers dominate the psi sciences and the psi industrial complex that meets out diagnoses and, of course, doles out medications and determines who is so dangerous to themselves or others, quote unquote, that they need to be locked away, or their autonomy and agency taken away. And absolutely, those function along lines of race and socioeconomic position and, educational background, disability status, all of these different things, like working in tandem or even compounding each other in some cases. I think a really famous historical example of this was when schizophrenia first started to gain traction with DSM fans, psi scientists, I should say, white cis women of a certain class that could afford to go to such doctors, they tended to be diagnosed with schizophrenia more than any other group. And then over time that shifted, where with the so-called turmoil of the civil rights movement and Black Power and the Black Panther Party and American Indian movement and different racialized groups trying to claim their rights and demonstrate their autonomy and agency as citizens in a settler state, that shifted so that Black men actually tended to be much more diagnosed than any other group, to the extent that, for example, you can look up a book called The Protest Psychosis, which refers to the way that Black men were overdiagnosed with schizophrenia in a particular time frame. It was politically expedient for psi scientists to target Black men with supposed mental disorders to take them off the playing board. When you are put away in a psychiatric institution, and I apologize, there's not a trigger warning for this, you lose a lot of rights. So
it was kind of a way to silence those voices?
Absolutely. I mean, when you call somebody crazy, and we do this a lot, this is a really common, mainstream thing to do. People casually throw around crazy, insane, stupid, and so forth. But in very targeted ways, when we want to gain power over someone or discredit them, we will challenge the soundness of their mind or the soundness of their logic by calling them or their ideas stupid or crazy.
Yeah.
And so as a person of a member of the dominant white culture in academia, but also a mad person, Liz, what are some of your goals for your dissertation?
Yeah, so... I'm early in the process, so I'm still figuring that out. But certainly, I do want to continue challenging myself. I've only been here a year and completed the majority of my coursework. And I am finding that a lot of my ideas continue to shift. So, for example, my personal introduction several years ago to what I later figured out was called mad studies, which you know, we can consider that problematic, like who's calling it mad studies, who gets to decide what mad studies is and that kind of thing. I was actually introduced to these concepts through Gloria Anzaldúa, who is not at all positioned by critical disability studies or feminist disability studies or mad studies as one of them, so to speak.
One of the scholars, you mean?
Exactly. Like, I think a lot of, especially white stream disability and mad studies people are like, oh, Anzaldúa is a Chicana feminist and she does like borderlands theory and that was her thing. She wasn't talking about what we're talking about, which I totally disagree. Like, I would not have all thought to pursue something in the vein of mad studies had I not found some of her really pivotal texts and started thinking of myself differently. So in a way, she also brought me to mad pride. Like, when I first read Borderlands La Frontera, I had just been, I'm outing myself here, but I just said I'm crazy, so it doesn't matter. I had just been, like, given a psychiatric diagnosis, different from the ones I had before, and I and it was like a struggle for me to think of myself differently under this different label. I had become so comfortable thinking of myself as a depressive, like, yeah, I am a depressive, I'm super depressed, and I'm cool with that. And so to have it suddenly changed was like, whoa, this older white dude is like telling me that I'm not what I thought I was for like a couple decades now. I didn't know how to reconcile myself with that until I read her book and realized that, are we allowed to swear? Probably not.
No.
So labels are bullcrap.
Right.
And the DSM is a fiction, a carefully authored and authorized fiction, and meant just many other things about identity categories and identity politics and even like her reluctance to apply labels to herself was like really compelling to me as someone who had adopted so many labels myself. Yeah.
And so coming to terms with these labels or kind of learning about your research before maybe you started your research, do you find that you're putting a lot of your personal experiences into your research and how you're moving forward? Are you trying to stay away from that? Or what is leading your research? Is it this exploration that was initiated by Anzaldúa, or are there other inspirations too?
So that's, I feel like there's a couple things in there that I think about a lot. So it seems like there's this general terror of vulnerability around oneself as a researcher or a teacher in academia, where we are super afraid to put ourselves in our work or in our teaching, just generally. And that's even strongly discouraged. Like, I've taught a couple undergraduate courses in WGSS now, and I still get a lot of science kids, like undergrad science kids, who are like, I can't use the first person pronoun in my writing. And I'm like, I'm the teacher and I'm telling you that you can. It's okay to do that. So this general discouragement of putting our lived experience into our work, which is very much not the case in WGSS, which is why I think I was drawn to this field in the first place. And again, you can challenge like what it means to say the field. Definitely that's something that the faculty in WGSS and QS at Oregon State are constantly pushing us to do, challenging us to think about where those boundaries lie and who and what are we talking about when we say women, gender, and sexuality studies or queer theory. And so I'm definitely taking a lot of those ideas and putting them into my research in tandem with my own lived experience. I find that I often don't write about my own experience that much because it is terrifying and it's scary to out oneself in any way, not because we necessarily want to keep up appearances of normativity, but it might put some people in danger. I think that's something else to keep in mind, is like, not everybody is going to be super open about like, I'm a psycho, you know, that's not going to be safe for some people. And especially where that collides with things like race and nationality mm-hmm. and so forth. And in terms of thinking about trajectories of fields and around WGSS and MAD studies, the faculty here has also really pushed me to think about what Sarah Ahmed calls citational practices. She says feminist citational practices. And so in terms of my citational practice, like when I think about people like Audre Lorde or Gloria Anzaldúa or other, especially feminists of color, in relation to MAD studies and disability studies, which is technically not canon as white stream academics are writing it, I'm not just trying to interrogate the quote-unquote field or raise questions. I'm also trying to figure out what my relationships are to those stories and histories, especially as a Euro settler moving around on stolen lands. Like, I'm from Michigan. Those are stolen lands. I moved to Oregon. Here we are on the lands of the Kalapuya people, also stolen lands. Yeah, so I think it's really hard to separate our lived experiences and the work that we do in a particular place and time from these much broader trajectories of space-time.
So one thing I'm wondering is what you described about writing in the first person. It seems like there's a certain amount of sort of projecting outward your internal experience, your own lived experience. And is there an association with maybe a connection with making, I guess, tailored recommendations about changes to policy or health? And are you more situated in the unpacking of the experience or the recommendation side of things? Where do those sort of coalesce, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really good question, which is like a recurring theme in WGSS classes, I find, is what's the point where we just stop tearing things apart and start building things, and can they happen simultaneously? And I absolutely think that that applies within MAD studies and disability studies, especially as like a WGSS trained person approaching these fields. Yeah, I had a thought and I lost it.
Yeah, that happens.
Yeah, it does.
So your research isn't, though, explicitly at this point focused on recommendations of how to, recommendations for health professionals about broadening their view of what madness is necessarily, but more of an examination, or how you're envisioning now, more of an examination of the history that kind of got us here to this point of reconciling these, more academia, the academy has accepted certain folks to belong to the field and folks to like not necessarily belong to the field, but women and gender studies and maybe MAD studies seems open to changing that lens and broadening the conception of the field.
Yeah, recommendations, that was the thing that I was gonna say.
Okay.
not only am I like, maybe it's just my personality that I'm personally reluctant to make, like, offer advice or make recommendations, but especially understanding myself as being, like, born into and raised within certain paradigms of privilege and power that, for me, often go unseen or unchallenged, or I'm not fully conscious of them all the time. I immediately have to take a step back and constantly reassess. And so I could make recommendations, the temptation is always there. I see psi scientists doing it all the time, even broad brushing within what are hugely diverse categories that they created. So if you take, for example, schizophrenia or borderline personality disorder, bipolar disorder, autism spectrum disorder, like all of these categories, these highly constructed categories that like flux over time, they contain a huge diversity of people that generally get distilled into like one or two kinds of patients that you're likely to encounter as a presumably white cis masculine psi scientist, and then how do you treat that person? And when the supposed anomaly comes along, will you even recognize them? Or will you treat them as you would these sort of archetypal conceptions of like, this is what a person with borderline personality disorder looks like? Yeah, in terms of recommendations, I think the sort of self-critical and self-reflective lens that queer studies and WGSS, I would say, is becoming more prevalent. That hasn't always been the case in these fields, but that's something that's definitely really critical to my work and that I see like really strongly encouraged in things like feminist disability studies and MAD studies. Not imagining that we construct a recommendation that will like somehow magically apply to everyone. I definitely think there are like really general guidelines that seem so general that they're almost not even worth saying, which I could offer a couple of my favorite ones if that is appropriate. So I'm a Daniel Heath Justice fan kid as well. My cohort, if they were listening to this, would be laughing right now, because I cite these questions all the time. But he poses what I see as like four incredibly poignant questions about what it means to be human as any kind of person in all our complexity. He says, how do we learn to be human? How do we behave as good relatives? How do we become good ancestors? And how do we learn to live together? And in isolation, each of those questions seems so simple. But each time I read them, they really tear me up, because I think it gets to the core of what it means to, regardless of whatever labels are forced onto someone or whatever identities we take onto ourselves, what it means for us, how we interact with each other, how we treat each other, where do loving compassion stand in that, if we have to recognize each other's humanity. Because people of color, disabled people, mad people, queer people, especially where those categories intersect, are often dehumanized. They're not recognized as human, which authorizes so much violence against them. That would be my recommendation, to think about those questions.
Okay, and kind of on this vein, a question that I have, I think we should talk about your background a little bit more after this. But before we do, also, I should remind the listeners that this is Inspiration Dissemination on KBVR Corvallis, and we are broadcasting from Oregon State University campus and talking to Liz Junk from the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Department here on campus. Liz, on the same vein of this recommendations, I know that we're moving away from that, but as a listener to this podcast and radio show, and now having more knowledge that this MAD studies exists and this concept of madness not being binary, and of people who are not neuronormative, what was the word that you used before? People who are
neurodivergent?
This concept of people who are neurodivergent falling into like a broad spectrum of different ways of mind, of different mind-body states, instead of being into these categories of what could be used as to pathologize or to diagnose someone with madness. So from listening to this radio show, we see there's, you know, this broader concept of there's just a diversity of people who fall into MAD. How does a listener be aware of this? Or how does a listener use this knowledge to maybe participate in the MAD Pride movement?
Yeah, good question. So I definitely think that there's probably a lot of MAD people listening to this right now who, I mean, if there were a lot of people listening to this, then proportionally speaking, some of them would be MAD and they had never thought of themselves like that. Or maybe they'd be like, I don't like that word. I'm bipolar, or I'm crazy, or I'm neuroqueer, or so just statistically speaking, I think that would be the case. Like, we imagine crazy people as anomalies, that, and there's only a few of us, and luckily we've been round up and medicated, and we're good to go. No, actually, MAD people are all over the place. I'm not going to make the, like, you know, cliche statistical comparison to redheads or something like that. Like, how many crazy people are there if you could visualize them like you could redheads? No. But even getting everybody to question, you know, where that line is, where the line is between wellness and unwellness. Certainly, I think a lot of people have experienced some super unwell days that maybe they were reluctant to identify as a crazy day, as a depressive day, because of the stigmas attached to that concept. But getting just everybody to rethink what we mean when we're talking about wellness and unwellness, and to remove the compulsion, that this idea of what Sarah Ahmed and other, especially queer theorists, call compulsory happiness, as if none of us can ever demonstrate our unwellness. So I think MAD Pride is often about, yeah, we are demonstrating our unwellness and we're proud of it and we're even happy about it. Wow, I'm like a happy depressive. There's a weird concept.
But it sounds like there's a certain amount of just embracing yourself as you are and just, accepting that and learning to sort of celebrate it.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I think MAD Pride is absolutely about celebration. And I've never heard any self-ascribed MAD person say that we're seeking tolerance or even acceptance. More like, we're here and we are human and we demand that you recognize our humanity. And if people begin to question, like, well, you know, I have had some really blue days and, like, I've had some really anxious days and I've had some really furious days, and, like, what quantity of days do I have before I suddenly am no longer normal? And who gets to decide that? And is that really fair? And then what happens to the people who don't have the agency to decide those things for themselves? I mean, children's, I think, a common example, where those decisions are often made for them about their body mind. Like, that's just, she was just such an unhappy child, so we took her to a therapist, that kind of narrative. And then for people who are reluctant to identify in any way with that, like, cluster of unwellness, we'll say, there's things that we can all be doing, such as consciousness about our language. And in the same way, like, I consider this a cuss word, so I won't say the R word.
Right.
Yeah. And in the 90s, I'm dating myself here, but that was, like, if you were riding the bus in the 90s, then somebody was calling somebody else the R word. That was just the way it was. Mm-hmm. It was just a really common way to disparage someone at the time. And it has sort of gone out of fashion. Like, it is no longer considered PC to just casually drop that word any old time we want. You will probably get a dirty look if you're around, quote unquote, progressive people. And in the same way, I hope that we will build a consciousness around other words that have to do with madness, mental illness, neurodivergence, disability, such as crazy, insane, idiot, dumb, lame. That's another one that's like quickly like coming to the point where it stings my ears. So there's just these words that we use all the time when we want to put somebody or something down. And they are immediately associated with disability and madness and so forth. And I think that just reiterates the lesser status that crazy people, mentally ill people, disabled people have in our culture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it gets to the point that you were making earlier where it's the sort of the closer you look at that line between illness and wellness, the harder it is to actually recognize and define the idea also that how many days, you know, does it take to qualify as mad? You know, that's it's difficult to define even. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think I want to know how did you become interested in MAD studies, or how has your educational career up to this point led you to pursuing a PhD at Oregon State University?
So I decided some years ago that I was going to come out as genderqueer and people were going to use my pronouns and I was going to be proud about that, right? And that's, you know, whatever. Lots of people in my life still really struggle with that, and that's okay. I'm not going to, like, correct the grocery store clerk or something. And parallel to that, I have been, up until very recently, very closeted as a crazy person. And, like, why would I out myself as that when on purpose, when I do it often unintentionally, way too often? Like, it has invited all kinds of harm and violence into my life when I like to say when I'm not in control of my mutant powers. I don't know if anybody watches Jessica Jones, but I'm like the suicidal and not homicidal version of her mother. Okay. That's like such a specific nerd reference. I'm sorry.
That's on my to watch list.
Oh, it's so good. Well, season 2 is bearable. Anyway, I digress. So, deciding to come to Oregon State was when I was applying to PhD programs, I had experienced a lot of stigma in my MA program, even from the very people who were writing my letters of recommendation. One of them, this was actually how I learned about, quick side story, how I learned that there was such a thing as quote-unquote MAD studies by that term was I was at a huge conference in my field. I happened to be walking in the book fair with a faculty member, and I saw this anthology, this big fat anthology from Canada called MAD Matters, and it was like an introduction to Canadian MAD studies or something to that effect, and I was like, what? MAD studies? Yeah. That's me. These are my people. Whatever that means. And I picked up the book and I was like, I'm just going to borrow this for 2 seconds. I'm not stealing it. And I ran over to my teacher and I was like, look at this. And she took one look at it and she rolled her eyes so hard. And I was crushed. And she left. And I was, in that moment, I was like, this, you know, this is not my place, and these are not the people who will accept me for who I am, but it exists. It is somewhere, and I'm going to find it. And lo and behold, like, because there are crazy people everywhere, it did so happen that there was a faculty member in a completely different college at my MA program school that I now consider him a MAD elder. And wow, there's not very many of them. We don't live very long. And yeah, I'm kind of a morbid sense of humor. I should tone that down. And so when I was writing my letters, my letters of intent and so forth for PhD programs, I put it right in there, like, I am crazy and I want to study crazy things. And Oregon State was like, we want you. And I was like, okay, these are some weirdos here. I'm just kidding. Not really, sort of. I love my faculty. Yeah. They're really stellar and brilliant, and even those who don't necessarily like affiliate themselves in an academic sense with disability studies or MAD studies, are incredibly supportive of the work that we're doing and of students who find themselves in those positionalities or identify themselves those ways. And especially like within my cohort and amongst my peers, I've found not just support, but like amazing collaboration and challenges to the way that I think and introductions to new stories and new narratives that push back on things that I was raised with. It involves a lot of unpacking. I'm not gonna lie, sometimes it's traumatic. but it's been a really supportive and wonderful experience. And I feel incredibly lucky to be here. I didn't think I was going to give some glowing review of Oregon State, honestly.
Well, just to fill in kind of like the chronological trajectory of your life. That's such a hard thing to do, I realize. But so you're at a conference and you find this, mad studies. Somebody's using this term to encapsulate or to like describe this that I have experience with. I'm so excited, shot down by someone that you look up to, perhaps. But then did you look deeper into what mad studies is and kind of find out, hey, this does exist and this is where I want to be and there's a lot of room for exploration here? And then you just like kind of ran with it and said the person or the school that is going to accept me for who I am is where I'm going to go. And then was it like kind of a test, like putting that into your letter and thinking, you know, they're going to take it or leave it. And then you find yourself here at Oregon State. Pleased by that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, when I came for my visit, I reiterated that. I was like, well, just in case, you know, we all have faculty. We write these 15-page papers and then they don't read it. And then they're like, here's a grade, but you know they didn't read it. And so I was like, well, maybe they didn't read my letter. That's absurd. Of course, they read everybody's letters. They won't let you in otherwise. But I was like, maybe they didn't read it, and I'm going to reiterate this. Like, no, I'm mad. I mean, mad like crazy, mad like this and that, not just angry. And this was a face-to-face interaction. And on multiple occasions, I've had faculty reiterate their support around and not in a paternalistic or patronizing way, as is often the case, you know, if you're visiting a therapist, perhaps, like, oh, poor you, that you have this thing that's wrong with you, but in a way that recognized my pride and even shared in it. And so I think that was like a really both hard and necessary decision for me when I was like, well, I've done this thing around my gender and I don't know why this feels so much harder and more dangerous, but I feel like I need to do it or I am going to keep living with this. And so many other people I know, like especially experiences from like my childhood and my young adult years, seeing really violent things happen to people as a result of what I would now recognize as madness, mental illness, neurodivergence, and just the possibilities that there are some ways I could help intervene on that, even if it starts with intervening on the problematic aspects of this field called mad studies.
So that kind of takes us to the next step, which is sort of future, looking to the future. So you're early in your program relatively, but do you have any ideas of what you will want to pursue after grad school here at OSU?
So I feel like I'm a bit of a stereotype in this way because I'm sure a lot of people are like, I want to be a tenure track professor and I want to do research. And I'm crazy, but I am also a bit mediocre. And so I don't see myself as some like Foucault or Judith Butler or Jasper Puar or what have you, that's going to be this rock star in my field and automatically guarantee myself one of those positions. But I do hope that whatever I do will involve teaching, bell hooks and Paulo Freire and many other super famous teachers and pedagogists talk about the power of teaching and not just in like shaping minds, so to speak, but in a mutual like breakage of consciousness or recreation of consciousness or co-construction of consciousness. There's many ways to think about it. And so I find teaching really exciting, and I also love research, but wherever I end up going, I hope that it involves like a co-generative teaching environment.
Okay. That's interesting. So by co-constructive, you mean sort of it's a teaching, it's a learning experience for the instructor as well.
Yeah, okay. Definitely. Mm-hmm. And like, which is already something that I've encountered, like both on this continent and on others, that students of all kinds and all ages are often frightened into silence by the power dynamic that so many teaching systems impose, especially really like westernized ones, like the ones that Freire was talking about, like the banking model of education, where the teacher opens the child's head and pours the knowledge in and they're good to go. I really hope that's not where the like future of knowledge production lies on this continent.
Sort of more transactional in a sense, it sounds like.
Definitely reciprocal. Yeah, I hope it is reciprocal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're getting down to the end of our time, unfortunately. But first, I do want to thank you for coming on the show. And I'm really interested to see kind of where your ideas lead you in your journey in getting this PhD and kind of like what new ideas come up. And so I'd encourage you to come on the show again when you have it, like maybe a little bit further ahead, where you kind of have maybe some stuff written or you've tried out some ideas for more conferences or something like that. But
awesome. That'd be great.
Ask two traditions or keep to two traditions on inspiration dissemination. And the first tradition is to ask you for your advice. And so I will ask you, what is your advice and who are you aiming? Who's the audience of your advice?
Ooh. Yeah, so I've been thinking a lot about grad students lately, in particular, coming back to school and being like, oh, these are the people that I will be saturated with again. Yep. And which is, you know, has its pros and cons. And so I guess this would be for my peers, my fellow grad students. I've been thinking about a concept from Gloria Anzaldúa that she calls spiritual activism. And I hope that my advice would be that we think of the work that we're doing here, be it research and or teaching, working on projects, as a form of spiritual activism, which is absolutely connected to Mad Studies and Disability Studies, but I guess we don't have time to talk about that. So that would be my advice.
Okay. So I'm curious, just briefly, the idea of spiritual activism. Can you delve into that a little bit?
Okay, cool. Yeah. So I think the way that maybe normatively positioned people would read Anzaldúa, the first thing they might think is like, this is crazy. Like, what is she talking about? Which is why I was immediately attracted to it. But imagining activism is not something that just takes place in the material realm, but that extends into our spiritual life is really important. So whether we're doing plant biology or chemistry or so forth, that these things also have spiritual aspects, which involve us all being connected to each other as living things.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
And our last tradition is to ask for an outro. So we're going to play a song of your request. And can you tell us a little bit why you chose the song that you chose?
Oh, yeah. It's from a movie called K-Pax. And I would critique that if we had time. And it's a movie about a crazy person that was near and dear to my heart for a long time. And this song was also like really potent to me at a period of time that I was particularly out of my mind. So that's why.
Okay. Well, thanks again for sharing all this with us. And we do hope that you come on the show again.
Thanks.